This episode contains descriptions of sex crimes. Listener discretion is advised. It was in July 1980 that Ronald Gene Simmons took a road trip with his oldest daughter, Sheila. She was always Simmons's favorite among his seven children. He did not show his anger toward Sheila like he did to his other kids. He was not as condescending to her. As she grew older, and his marriage became more and more strained, Simmons treated Sheila far more lovingly than his wife, Becky. Simmons and his daughter were headed from their home in New Mexico to California for a coin show. Coin collecting was something that Simmons loved, but Sheila only pretended to love it to please her dad. For a while, Sheila appreciated being doted on by her father. She knew it made her other siblings jealous, and that certainly affected her. But she was simply relieved not to elicit his wrath. She had access to the softer side of Ronald Gene Simmons. She did not quite understand why that was the case, but it was better than the side her brothers, Little Gene and Billy, regularly saw. And it was definitely better than what her mom was subjected to. Simmons would call Sheila his little princess. Of all the pet names he used for his daughter, that was the one he used the most. It was during that long drive west that Simmons steered their conversations into dark and uncomfortable places. They made it to Phoenix, where they would spend the night at a hotel before heading to California. In that hotel room, according to authorities, is where Simmons had sex with his daughter for the first time. Presented by the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, you're listening to The Devil of Pope County, America's Worst Family Massacre. In the spring of 1976, Ronald Gene Simmons was a 35-year-old non-commissioned officer in the U.S. Air Force. He earned the rank of Master Sergeant and had just completed a 3-year stint in England. That is where the couple's fourth child and fifth child, Loretta and Eddie, were born. Simmons flew back to the States first and spent about a month getting everything set up before his family joined him. After his time in England, Simmons was stationed at Alamogordo, located in the Sacramento Mountains in New Mexico, about 90 miles southwest of where the world's first plutonium implosion device was tested 3 decades earlier. Simmons preferred the quiet life, and he had an aptitude for computers. So a new post in a faraway place overseeing so much powerful hardware fitted him like a tailored suit. He worked at SAMSO, an acronym for Space and Missile Systems Organization. The observatory he worked in was staffed by an officer who held the rank of captain and 7 NCOs. Simmons was the highest-ranking NCO there, so whenever the commanding officer was away, Simmons was the one in charge. Simmons's military career was a decorated one, and so much of the work he did while in the Air Force required top-secret clearance. He excelled at the work and loved the thought of doing something that so few people had the privilege of knowing about. The job was mostly administrative, perfect for someone with the keen sense of detail that Simmons had. He thrived there. For a time, Simmons considered the area around Alamogordo as an appropriate place to build a home and settle down. His family was going to fly in from England in May, a month or so after Simmons settled in Alamogordo. He found a house to rent, but he knew it would only be temporary. The neighbors were too close for his liking. When it came time for his family to join him, Simmons flew his wife and their 5 kids to San Francisco. He joined his family there, and they visited Disneyland and SeaWorld, enjoyed a fun family vacation complete with t-shirts and other souvenirs, and then they drove to their new home in New Mexico. Becky, who was an abused wife, was originally from New Mexico and recalled her life there fondly. She hoped this would be a new beginning. More happiness, less darkness. Becky's older sister, Viola O'Shields, spoke to THV 11 in 1990 about Becky, and the man she married. To hear her tell it, there was actually a time when Jean and Becky had a more blissful life.
He was a very loving man at one time. He loved his family.
The first time Ronald Jean Simmons entered the military was in September 1957, when he was 17 years old. His first entry into the U.S. military was not through the Air Force. He had enlisted in the Navy first, and following boot camp, he spent 19 months in Guam, where he earned his GED. While a child, Simmons regularly challenged authority, formed a reputation as a bully, and was pulled in and out of boarding schools that were designed to rehabilitate troubled boys. But during his young adult life, Simmons was the farthest thing from a rule breaker. He loved the military, and the military seemed to love him back. Images of Simmons in his enlisted service dress white uniform were used by the Navy in recruitment posters and pamphlets. He was riding high then, and that was when he met Becky, while stationed at the Bremerton Naval Base in Washington State. At the time, Becky was a typist for the United Service Organization. Becky was fast on the keys, but Simmons thought he could beat her, and he challenged her to a speed typing contest. He won, but Becky did not mind. She was attracted to the young sailor, and pretty soon they began dating. Jean was drawn to Becky immediately. She was petite, with long dark hair and dark eyes. Her future daughters would all resemble her. Becky was smitten too, and could not get over how confident the new man in her life was, and how open he was about his feelings and goals. He left such an impression on the 18-year-old Becky. She'd never met anyone like Jean before. Becky was ready for a strong man in her life, one who put his focus on her. Becky's biological father had abandoned her family when she was young. Becky's mother remarried and moved the family from New Mexico to Colorado, which was where Becky's stepfather found work as a coal miner. Becky's mother and stepfather had children of their own, and in Becky's eyes, her younger half-siblings were more loved than she ever was. She left home after high school, soon volunteered at the USO, and met her future husband, Jean, who had a bad relationship with his own stepfather growing up, seemed the perfect match for Becky, and vice versa. The couple got married in July 1960, on Becky's 19th birthday. Becky would later tell one of her sisters that before she married Jean, his own mother warned her about him. She said Jean was overly controlling and temperamental. Becky was too love blind to heed her warnings. The dynamic of the marriage changed in a big way after Ronald Jean Simmons returned home from Vietnam. By then, he was out of the Navy, had enlisted in the Air Force, and Becky had given birth to the couple's three oldest children. Becky and her husband were no longer a loving couple after the latter completed his combat duty. Simmons's fuse was shorter, and his controlling nature was fully manifested. Becky became more submissive and tried her best to protect her children from their father's anger. That's why she hoped a return to New Mexico would help them turn the tide to the way things were prior to her husband's combat service. On June 3, 1976, a month and a day before the country would celebrate its bicentennial, the Simmons family was together again in New Mexico. The shine from their Disneyland vacation wore off quickly. Because of their relative proximity to Becky's parents in Walsingburg, Colorado, the Simmons family drove to visit them later that year. They spent time with Becky's mom, May Novak, who never had warm feelings for her son-in-law. Becky's siblings got an even uglier vibe from Simmons. He, in turn, had nothing positive to say about his wife's sisters and did not trust them. But one thing Simmons did like about visiting his wife's family in Walsenburg was seeing the kind of lifestyle the Novaks enjoyed. The more he stayed there, the less favorably he saw how his own life was going in Alamogordo. It was not farm life. That's what Simmons's in-laws had, and that's what he coveted. Simmons had spent some time as a child in Hector, Arkansas, which is on the edge of the Ozarks in Pope County. He actually lived there from the time he was 6 until shortly after he turned 10 years old, and that was the happiest period of his life. It was during that visit to Colorado that Simmons made up his mind to look for a new home. Ultimately, he wanted to be back in Arkansas, but in the meantime, he found a home in New Mexico in a remote place called Wills Canyon, a community near Cloudcroft. Located in Otero County, Cloudcroft is considered the southernmost ski area in the United States. It has an altitude of more than 9,000 feet and is a short drive from West Texas. It's in the Southern Rockies and is part of the Lincoln National Forest, about a 3.5-hour drive from Albuquerque, which is to the north. The Simmons home in Cloudcroft had 3 bedrooms, including one upstairs under the eaves. It was on 3 acres, not quite large enough for Simmons, but it provided enough land space so that his neighbors were not too close. Simmons bought the house for $24,000. He paid $10,000 and then paid the rest across the next 5 years. He made the last payment just before he and his family moved out of state. In 1987, the Arkansas Democrat employed a young investigative reporter by the name of Pat Rice. Pat's career would eventually take him to Florida, where he would become my editor for 7 years. His time at the Democrat was foundational. You could say he was a field operative during the epic newspaper war between the Democrat and the Arkansas Gazette. Pat knew what it was like in the days when reporters for the Democrat would feel their hearts skip a beat whenever they reached for the day's Gazette. If the Gazette had something in the paper that the Democrat reporter did not have, but should have had, whether it was a small detail or a big scoop, that Democrat reporter would expect a one-sided, heated conversation with an editor. The same could probably be said about reporters at the Gazette. But there was a different mindset at the Democrat, an underdog mindset. The Arkansas Democrat was locally owned, family owned. The Gazette was corporate owned. Here is Pat describing what the newspaper war was like from the perspective of a Democrat reporter.
By that time, there was a real, you know, kind of a sense at the Democrat, and I think a sense at the Gazette, was that it was a newspaper war to the death. The Arkansas Democrat, we were a smaller staff. At that time, we did not have as much circulation. We did not have as much advertising, but the Arkansas Democrat staff was very tenacious and had a lot of good journalists and had its roots in Arkansas. And that was a real drawback for Gannett. The Arkansas Democrat saw themselves truly, and I think that newsroom did, as Arkansas's newspaper. Bred within all of that and that notion that it was a newspaper word to the dead, people would work hard, and it was one of those places where pretty much everybody in town got both newspapers, and certainly everybody in the newsroom did. So I'd look at what the Gazette had and what the Democrat had before I ever got into the newsroom, while I'm eating breakfast. You know, I was on special projects, so our main job was to come up with scoops. But on a breaking news story like that, whoever was involved in it, you know, went after it hard, because you did not want to walk into the newsroom and have Ray or somebody, or John Robert Starr, or somebody point out to you that you got your ass beat.
During the late 1980s, a young reporter at the Hot Springs Sentinel Record was ready for a step up in his career. His name was Scott Bowles. The bigger paper he joined was the Arkansas Democrat, because its owner, Walter Hussman, also owned the Sentinel Record. Scott's move to the Democrat seemed to be the easiest one to make. He applied for a job at the Gazette, but was passed over. Scott would go on to have an impressive career at the Detroit News, the Washington Post, and USA Today. Here he is describing what it was like 35 years ago, being wanted by the Democrat and initially rejected by the Gazette.
The Gazette told me they were not going to hire me. Knew the Democrat was interested, but the Gazette had the history. It won the Pulitzer. It was, I believe, the longest-running daily west of the Mississippi. It had history. I wanted to go there.
The managing editor of the Democrat at the time was John Robert Starr, and he led the newsroom with a clenched iron fist. Scott still remembers what it was like working for the Democrat under Starr's leadership.
It was so intense. I remember the Democrat, John Robert Starr, would send a note every day at the Democrat, not personally, to the staff, what the Democrat beat the Gazette at, what the Gazette beat the Democrat at, and never let the latter happen again. It was almost a pre-scolding.
Scott's time with the Democrat was short. The editors at the Gazette did a 180 about a month after Bowles made his move from Hot Springs to Little Rock. They decided they wanted him to join their staff after all. Scott accepted the Gazette's offer. In retrospect, he was naive about how his editors at the Democrat would react.
Suddenly, the Gazette called with an offer, and it was a good offer. And I will never forget it. They made the offer, and I said, well, I need to give the Democrat 2 weeks. And Bob Stover, the editor then at the Gazette, said, well, you can do that, but I don't think you'll need to. And sure enough, I was carrying my Radio Shack laptop, those old laptops you had to hook up to a phone, and I had it over my shoulder. And I told Bob Letkin, it was an offer I couldn't turn down. And Bob told me, you will never cover real news. You will only write fluff. But if that's your decision, you can put the laptop down and get the hell out of the building. And so I just walked down the street and told the Gazette, you were right. They did not want to see my face.
Scott would always remember that comment by Bob Letkin, that he would be relegated to writing fluff. It motivated him a lot. He'd later pour his heart and soul into covering the Simmons case. You'll hear more from Scott later in the series. Just before the calendar flip from 1987 to 1988, both the Democrat and Gazette had stories all over their front and inside pages about the family massacre discovered by the Pope County Sheriff's Office. For a few days at least, there was not a single international story on the front page. Both papers reported the total death toll of 16 and gave detailed accounts of the bodies that were found buried on the property. Both papers also referenced the incestuous relationship that Simmons had with his oldest daughter, Sheila. The Gazette had more information about the relationship because one of the reporters there tracked down and interviewed one of Becky's sisters. She had a lot to say about it. The editors at the Democrat decided it would be good to kick over a few more rocks and find out how much they could about Simmons's predatory behavior, and they called upon Pat Rice to do so. Pat learned that New Mexico authorities had actually investigated Simmons for incest through a battery of phone calls and a few faxes. Pat was able to gather enough information for a couple of strong front-page stories. The Democrat gained an edge over its counterpart, but Pat's editors were not satisfied. They wanted Pat to find out as much as he could and really blow the lid off the story, and they knew he was not going to be able to do that relying only on a phone and a fax machine.
After the second story that I wrote, I came in, or it may have been at the end of the day there, and Ray Hobbs, the city editor, walked up to me with sort of a half a smile on his face, and said, hey, you're going to New Mexico, and gave me a plane ticket.
During his trip to New Mexico, Pat would visit the property where Simmons and his family had lived years earlier. He noticed something very unusual about it.
When I was up in Cloudcroft, I got directions to where their home was. It was probably 7-8 miles down some mountain roads outside of Cloudcroft. When I got to the property, what really struck me, and people had told me this, that on after school and on weekends, the main things that the kids did during the day were go around and find rocks. They were building like a stone wall around the property. And it wasn't like a wall. It was just like, you know, I guess it was a wall, but it was like, I don't know if you've ever seen any of these stone walls like in New England, you know, between property lines. Well, it was like that, only it was, gosh, I think it was about 10, 12 feet tall. And the number of rocks, it wasn't like, you know, a foot wide and 10 feet tall. It was like 15 feet, 20 feet wide that it had to be for them to keep stacking until they got that many rocks there. I just thought to myself, I wonder how much time those kids put into building that wall, because it was around the entire property. It was just weird. It was spooky.
By late 1976, living in that house in Cloudcroft was a struggle for everyone in the Simmons household. The kids were struggling in school because they were so exhausted from being so overworked, hauling rocks and performing other labor around the property. In November of that year, Simmons received unsettling news. The SAMHSA Observatory was no longer going to be staffed by him and a handful of airmen. Those responsibilities were being handed over to a smaller, less expensive mobile unit. He fought that transition as best he could. Simmons worked longer hours so that the NCO staff could be reduced. That bought him some time, but that only meant that Becky and the children carried more of the burden at home, and that caused more tension and Simmons's temper to flare even more. The family's sixth child was born around that time, Marianne Michelle. Bills were piling up, and the job at SAMHSA was likely to come to an end at any moment with little or no warning. Finally, it happened. The Air Force announced the official deactivation of the observatory, effective in June 1978. A few months earlier, Simmons got word he would be transferred to Holloman Air Force Base by the end of July. The base was also located in Otero County. Little Rock Air Force Base was his first choice. Holloman was his second, and he'd only given the Air Force two choices for his transfer. So in June, Simmons was transferred from the observatory to Holloman. That summer in 1978, Simmons lost it and did something he'd never done before. He struck his wife in front of the children. The older kids knew their father had been physical with their mother, but this was the first time it happened in front of them. Little Jean, who by that time was 16 years old, refused to sit back and watch. The teenager tried to protect his mother, but he was physically no match for his father, who beat him to the floor and kept beating him while he lay. The family watched in horror, bruised, angry, and filled with hatred for his father. Little Jean left home 2 days later and hitchhiked to Maine Novak's home in Colorado. His father drove to get him, and he was accompanied by his wife and his oldest daughter, Sheila. May noticed something strange when Simmons pulled up. Sheila was in the front seat, while his wife was in the back seat. That did not look right to her. May also accused Simmons of abusing and overworking his children, but he waved her off. Simmons drove his son home, and the two barely spoke to each other afterward. Little Jean wanted nothing more than to be out on his own, away from his father's reach. He wanted that for his family, too. He knew they would never be safe living under the thumb of such a monster. That August, Simmons was up for a promotion to become an E-8, a senior master sergeant, which surely meant a transfer to Turkey. He refused it and notified the Air Force of his plans to retire. That meant he would receive only half pay once he was honorably discharged. His Air Force career came to an end by December 1979. His behavior toward his wife was worse than ever before. Becky dreaded her husband's retirement because his sour attitude was only getting worse. By that time, Becky had given birth to her and her husband's seventh child, Rebecca Lynn. Without the military, Simmons was floundering. He felt inadequate, and that only made his mercurial manner worsen. Meanwhile, due to his waning desire for his wife, his lust for his own daughter kept intensifying. Fast forward to August 1980. After Sheila and her father got back from that coin show trip to California, Becky sensed things were different between her husband and oldest daughter. She did not like the thought of Simmons leaving town with Sheila, but at the same time, the extended time away from him would be good for her and their younger children. She had conflicting emotions about it, but shortly following their return, Becky better understood that the vileness of her husband had no bounds. Based on social workers' investigations, Simmons had sexual intercourse with Sheila two more times in September 1980. By March of 1981, Sheila realized she was pregnant and told her father. Simmons sat down with Becky and gave her the news. He said there would be no further discussion about it and that the baby would be loved like all of the other children in the house. Simmons did not disclose who the father was, but he didn't need to. Becky knew immediately. Becky told little Gene about it, and he nearly reported it, but Becky urged him not to. If the authorities found out, she and the family would lose everything. Becky wanted to keep the family together for as long as she could before she could find the strength and the means to move herself and her children out of the house. Little Gene obeyed his mother for a few days, but he desperately needed to tell someone. He confided in a classmate, who then urged him to call social services. Eventually, he did. On April 17, 1981, almost 4 weeks after his father told his mother that Sheila was pregnant, little Gene contacted the authorities. He called two more times during the next 3 days and kept those calls anonymous. In late 1987, Pat interviewed a couple in Cloudcroft. Little Gene stayed with them during his last year in high school and beyond. That couple told Pat that little Gene thought very highly of his mother and loved his brothers and sisters, but hated his father. Pat also interviewed one of little Gene's closest friends in Cloudcroft. That friend told Pat that little Gene was basically scared of his father and scared of what his father might do to his family if he was turned in. Little Gene also worried about the family being forced to split up. But the seriousness of the crime against Sheila was too much for him not to come forward. Simultaneous to little Gene's efforts to have social services intervene, school officials in Otero County started to suspect on their own that something nefarious was going on between Simmons and his daughter.
All the kids went on the bus, but he would drive that girl to school himself. And that there were concerns because people had seen him kissing her in the car and those sorts of things. And it was the school officials who blew the whistle on him, I think. You know, went to law enforcement and said that there's something wrong with this relationship.
Social services launched an investigation, and the district attorney's office in Otero County was notified. On April 20th, a caseworker went to Cloudcroft to investigate the rumors. Sheila met privately with a caseworker and she confirmed the caseworker's suspicions. She admitted that she had sex with her father and was pregnant with his child. The caseworker drove to Wills Canyon and confronted Simmons. He did not deny it either. He told the caseworker he did what he did to protect his daughter and that it was his fatherly duty. He insisted he knew what he was doing and that he and his family did not require any help. The caseworker spoke to other people too, many of whom said they had their own suspicions, independent of any rumors. It was clear that Simmons was openly amorous toward his daughter. He showed no effort to hide it. The next day, an assistant prosecutor in Otero County was notified. Simmons ultimately agreed to a program of psychological counseling that would include his entire family. He agreed to it under the threat of prosecution. The family therapy lasted 5 weeks. Simmons realized what was happening. No matter how much counseling he underwent or how much he tried to talk his way out of the trouble he was in, he was ultimately going to be prosecuted. Any admission of criminal activity he had made at this point was going to be used against him in a court of law. A request by the caseworker was filed through the district attorney's office to have Simmons's daughters removed from the house, place Ronald Gene Simmons on pre-prosecution probation, and have continued counseling for him and Becky. Through his reporting, Pat not only learned about that request, but he also learned that it was never acted upon and no valid reason was given. Meanwhile, Word kept spreading about Simmons and his incestuous relationship with Sheila. So before long, Simmons was persona non grata in Cloudcroft. People at Sheila's school knew about it, and the students there were telling their parents about it. On June 17th, Sheila gave birth to a daughter, Sylvia Gale. On June 20th, a sheriff's deputy from Otero County came to Wills Canyon and interviewed Sheila. Becky was there. Sheila refused to cooperate. Sheila eventually had to go before a grand jury. If she refused to talk while on the stand, she would go to jail. So in early August 1981, jurors heard Sheila admit that her father had raped her and impregnated her. An indictment was imminent. Ronald Gene Simmons sensed that, so he left New Mexico and took his family with him. On August 10th, 4 days after Simmons left New Mexico for good, the Otero County Sheriff's Office showed up at the Simmons house in Cloudcroft with an arrest warrant. The house was deserted. The family had left in the middle of the night. They moved to Ward, Arkansas, a small city northeast of Little Rock. Not long after that, they moved to their final home together in Pope County. Simmons lived a total of 6 years and 4 months in Arkansas with his family. For much of that time, the incest continued. In the days following the murders, Pat Rice interviewed Walt Patterson, who was the head of human services in Arkansas at the time. Patterson told Pat that records are purged every few years and that all of the documents that contained the answers he was seeking were all shredded and trashed years earlier. Patterson also described the information his agency received from New Mexico authorities as flimsy. Pat discovered that in March 1982, 7 months or so after the Simmons family left New Mexico, that authorities in Otero notified Patterson's agency that Ronald Gene Simmons had been indicted on charges of incest. Human services lacked arrest powers, so there wasn't anything employees there could do, even if they did locate Simmons. On top of that, the Otero County District Attorney's Office dropped its case once it became clear to them that Simmons was gone. Rice had a litany of questions for Patterson, and at one point, Patterson got defensive during the interview and said to Pat, quote, "What did they want us to do? We're supposed to have helicopters with binoculars scouring the state for this guy?" End quote. Patterson pointed out that if Simmons was under indictment in New Mexico, then law enforcement in Arkansas, namely the state police, should have been notified, not just his agency. State police was the agency that had the power to arrest Simmons. Patterson also blamed authorities in New Mexico for not tracing Simmons's veteran benefits and for not tracing his children's school records. Patterson insinuated that authorities in Otero County were relieved Simmons was out of their hair and lacked the resolve to track him down. To Patterson, Otero's attitude was that Simmons was Arkansas's problem now. Let the authorities there deal with it.
He was definitely defensive. I guess a couple of things with that. One is, you know, if you put it in context, this guy had just killed 16 people. It was the worst murder in Arkansas history. And so this had just occurred. And then, you know, a reporter calls you and says, hey, they have said that they've sent you information about this or your department several years ago and nothing was ever done. I'm interpreting, but my interpretation would be that either he nor Arkansas Human Services wanted to be viewed as the one who dropped the ball on a case that was then turned this bad.
Cavalier attitude aside, Patterson was not completely off base. The dropped charges indicate that New Mexico did not have much interest in pursuing the case after Simmons had left. Surely nothing was stopping Patterson from reaching out to the Arkansas State Police on his own, but it isn't known how such a call would have been treated. It might have been treated like any other random tip. It wasn't his agency that indicted Simmons. Such a call would likely have been taken more seriously had it come from someone working in an official capacity in Otero County. And it wasn't only a matter of Arkansas authorities being eager to lay the blame on New Mexico authorities. Some finger-pointing was happening between agencies in New Mexico as well, especially after they learned that Simmons had murdered his entire family in late 1987. It was learned that the Otero Sheriff's Office and the District Attorney's Office did not see eye to eye on how the case should have been handled once Simmons fled the state.
I remember the sheriff was somewhat critical. I think he felt like, you know, it was the prosecutor's office, to their job to pursue this guy. And once he was indicted and he fled the state, that there wasn't a lot of pursuit.
The Otero County Sheriff also told Pat on the record that his agency was never told that the DA's office suspected Simmons was in Arkansas. The sheriff indicated that someone at his agency would have made some phone calls to law enforcement in Arkansas had his detectives known where Simmons had fled. The Otero County DA, as it turned out, was not devoid of remorse or anger. He conveyed his disgust that Simmons got away before he could be arrested. He told Pat, quote, "He split in the night. It angered me then, and it angers me now," end quote. Either way, there was no sign anywhere of any dogged pursuit of a suspected sexual predator who preyed on his own daughter.
It wasn't so much, I don't think in this case, it was so much swept under the rug as they created a record that said they'd gone after him, but he got away, and I don't think there was a great deal of effort once he got away to corral him.
6 years after Simmons got away, 16 people got killed. By early 1988, Ronald Gene Simmons was finally confined to a jail cell awaiting trial for murder. He did not have to wait long. Simmons was the last person who was going to waive his speedy trial rights. He wanted to stand trial as soon as possible. The state did not seem to mind. Coming up on The Devil of Pope County, America's worst family massacre.
Well, it was very quiet. A lot of security and a lot of people. You know, it was a more full courtroom.
That was a very uncommon thing. It's a round bag and it didn't fit in square hole.
MNM, and he wouldn't tell me what it was. In his mind, it was very clear to him what it stood for.
The Devil of Pope County is written and hosted by Tony Holt, produced by Kyle McDaniel, and presented by the Arkansas Democrat Gazette.